Well, good morning. Good morning, everyone. I'm really happy to be here. I was saying to Rich earlier that on days like today, when I come to the KTC and I'm doing Dharma student interviews from like 9 o'clock till 11 o'clock, I sometimes don't get a chance to meet everybody up in the atrium and say hi and to greet everybody. And it's one of the things that gives me a great deal of joy is to be able to meet everybody who's here and to thank all of you for coming to the center and being here and bringing your sincerity and enthusiasm to our halls. I want to apologize, first of all, for being somewhat out of uniform. I'm supposed to be wearing a white shawl. My white shawl is on vacation right now in Woodstock, New York, at our home monastery, Karma Triana Dharma Chakra. I left it there before I came home from KTD Monastery a couple of weeks ago. And I said, I know I'm forgetting something. What is it? And I remembered the rest of the uniform, but I didn't remember the shawl. So at any rate, the shawl will be back. The shawl will be back when I return on the 23rd. I'll be back here on the 23rd. I have to go get my shawl, after all. I'll be going to KTD this week to help with a teaching program. And then after that, I'll be back. But before we get started on the talk today, I want to give you a brief update on how things are going with the KTC Rebuilding Project. Very soon, you will see the Rebuilding Project flyers, beautifully designed by Tom Earlywine of the Athens, Ohio Karma Teksin Choling Center. They talk about the fundraising that we're going to be doing to rebuild our temple. This week's news is that we met a gentleman who I think may become our next generation architect. Those of you who were here a few months ago to meet Keith Spruce, the architect who drew our plans over there, will know that architecture is a complicated business. And we needed to have an architect who was licensed in the state of Ohio. And so Keith will be handing off Keith is from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and is licensed in that state, so we needed to get another person to come in and finish the work that he began. So we met with the gentleman who we think will be our new architect this week, and he's got a great sense of humor, which means we'll all get along. He also loves the design, so that's a good start. That means that there hopefully won't be a lot of fighting. I mean, oh, sorry, professional disagreements. Additionally, when I was at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Monastery in March, our founding teacher, Kempo Carter Rinpoche, made a generous donation to us of about $1,000 from people who had given him donations during a program that he was involved in. And then a week or so later, he sent us another donation. So Kempo Carter Rinpoche is now, I think he's going to hit the leaderboard soon, if we create such a thing, which we don't have, but we should aim it. Let's make a leaderboard, like in the PGA golf tournaments, right? We'll have a leaderboard. But he's, if we had one, he'd be on it, because he's given more than $5,000, maybe upwards of 10 now, just in giving these small donations whenever he receives them. I remember when we first visited him after the center burned in January of 2016, one of the first things he said was, oh my goodness, he said, this is a bad situation. He said, I just gave all of my money away. He had just visited the head of our tradition, His Holiness the Karmapa, in India, and made a generous donation of pretty much all of his worldly possessions. He gave them to Karmapa to use to take care of the monks and nuns in the exile community in India and Nepal. So he said, it's kind of unfortunate that you should come to me today, because I've just given everything away. He said, but I will give you money as I can. There's a thank you card for him over on the table. Jessica, are you over? Yeah, could you hold that up and show folks? You can go sign it. Even if you don't know Rinpoche real well, just go and put your name on it anyway and let him know how much you care about and thank him for his generosity to us. There are other things I could talk about regarding the rebuilding project today, but I think the main thing to know is that we're moving into the next phase of fundraising, so you're going to be hearing a bit about fundraising. I know somebody told me, they said, well, I don't have a lot of money, so I feel bad when I hear people talk about fundraising, and I said, I understand. I remember being a college student and not having any money at all. And then graduating from college and not having any money at all. And then going to work and not having any money at all. So I can really kind of empathize with the situation. So what I'm telling everybody is if you don't have a lot of money, maybe you know somebody who has some. This comes directly to me from Kempo Carter Rinpoche. When I was visiting Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Monastery, and he made this donation to us, he said, oh, by the way, he said, you should start looking around among your circle of friends and see if you know anybody who has personal wealth or who owns a business. Maybe they need to make a donation. So we're going to be asking everybody, even if you yourself cannot assist, maybe you know somebody. We were just having a conversation now about a children's author who went to visit Karmapa last year. So you can be sure that as soon as I find that person, I will write him a letter. But even if money is not your thing, you can pray for us. So please think about doing that. Please send a lot of good energy our way. That's something that doesn't cost anything, and it's something that you can do and make a regular donation of and not be without resources. If every day when you get up you say, may the Columbus KTC be rebuilt and be beautiful and be helpful to all sentient beings, wonderful. Just do that. And if you do that, then you can consider yourself a person who has donated to the cause, and who has donated their energy and their generosity of spirit. So anyway, I just thought I would tell you that. We're all going to be working on it for months now, and so I want to thank you for that. Now, today I'm going to start a series of four lectures. Don't worry if you only are able to hear today's lecture and can't attend any of the others. It will be fine because the lectures are all connected to one another. And the reason I wanted to teach this particular topic is because many people come to me and they say, oh, I really love the philosophy of Buddhism. The philosophy of Buddhism speaks to me. The things I read in Buddhist books are things that I feel like I have believed for a long time. But I don't know how to practice. I don't know how to enter the door of the Dharma and make the Buddhist teachings, the Dharma, my life. I don't know how to do that, how to incorporate the Dharma into my life. And so I decided to teach that topic in four parts. The design that I chose for this is a design that was created by the great master Gampopa, who lived in the 1100s. And he wrote a masterful book about Buddhism called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And this, and basically what this book tells us is that all beings have the potential to awaken as Buddhas. That's how the book starts. It's a very exciting story. It's a very exciting story. It's our story, really. It's every person's story. All beings have the potential to be Buddhas, but because of negative habitual patterns, they fail to see their Buddha nature. And even if they see and understand or believe in their ability to become Buddhas, they may not possess the tools or the methods that they can use to bring their Buddha nature to the forefront of their life. And then the book goes into the exciting middle portion where it shows us how to uncover our Buddha nature, how to live it out through the practices of ethics, through the practice of taking refuge in the Buddha as our teacher, the Dharma as our path, and the Sangha as our community. And then through something called bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening and citta means mind. Through the six perfect virtues of generosity, learning how to be generous and how to be grateful. Learning ethics, learning patience, learning diligence, meditation, and developing wisdom. And so the book, the exciting conclusion of this book is Buddhahood. And it explains all of the qualities that arise from Buddhahood if we accomplish our Buddha nature. And so it's a very exciting story. It's a little hard to work through. It's a little bit of a slog in places. But Gampopa wanted to lay it out from beginning to end so that we would see that our story as a person who is potentially a Buddha has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that it's something that is attainable by us. In the first part of the book, he says, Buddha nature pervades beings, just like butter pervades whole milk. If you have a container of whole milk with the cream included, and you churn that milk, it will become butter. The butter will come out from it and be of use. And it's just like that. He said, Buddha nature pervades beings. That means that right now, in this moment, you have Buddha nature. You have it right now. It's within you right now. It's imminent right now. It's here right now. And yet, because we don't know this, we are very busy and stay very busy with our daily habits of thinking, our daily habits of doing, our daily habits of being. And so what we need to do as practitioners is come to recognize this all-pervasiveness. And I guess you could say, like my friends in 12-step like to say, I came to believe that I had Buddha nature. I came to believe that there would be methods that could actually help me bring my Buddha nature to fruition. I came to believe that, and coming to believe that, I take hold of the methods, and putting those methods to work in my life, I begin to uncover, little by little by little, the qualities of Buddhahood. My teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, likes to talk about the Dharma path as being a path of purifying our confusion and turning our confusion into wisdom. The analogy he has used for that in the past is something you might be familiar with. It's the analogy of the encrusted cooking pot. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but it has happened to me. You know, you have maybe a very expensive piece of cookware that either was gifted to you or you purchased. Maybe it's one of those beautiful stainless steel cooking pots, and you've used it to cook something for a dinner party, and then you put it in the pantry because you were too busy to wash it. And it remains there for weeks. And then a few weeks afterwards, you begin to notice a smell, and it's coming from the pantry. You open the pantry door and recognize what you have done. You pull out the cooking pot, and it's in pretty rough shape. It not only has encrusted cooked food on it, it has a science project of mold going on inside it. It's covered in a science project like mold. And you know that you have no choice because it is so expensive, or because it was a gift from your parents or your grandparents. You know you have to clean this cooking pot. So you hold your nose and you put it in the sink. and it's hard. You get the scrubbing, and you can't scrub it, so you have to let it sit for a while, nicely smelling in your sink. And then later you bring the scouring pad and you start to scour the inside, and it gets to look worse. You put soap in, maybe that will help. And then slowly the gunk starts coming off. And as the gunk starts coming off the inside of the pot, you'll see a glint of silver. And you'll think, oh, it's still all right underneath that. And then you'll be able to put a little more elbow grease into it because you see the little glint of the stainless steel. This is like our Buddhist path. We come to the Buddhist path as imperfect beings, perhaps with some, shall we say, negative habits. You could be like me and lose your temper sometimes. Or maybe you could lose your temper like me a little more than sometimes. Maybe you can have a bit of a sharp tongue sometimes. Maybe you have a tendency to dislike a certain type of person, or somebody really gets your goat, or whatever. And you lose patience with people easily. Perhaps that's your habitual pattern. Or perhaps your habitual pattern is being lost in distraction. Lost in distraction, reading the internet hour after hour, and not really doing the things that you mean to do because it's so interesting, it's so fascinating. So it could be that that's a habit. There are all kinds of habits we can develop. But the practice of Dharma helps us to work with the habits. It helps us to work with those habits. And as we begin to let go of the habits, we see that glint of silver. We see that little bit of satisfaction and comfort and relaxation in the mind that comes from doing the practice of meditation. That is our Buddha nature showing through. And that makes it worthwhile for us, and it makes us keep going and keep applying that elbow grease to the cooking pot that is our being. And so eventually, after much time has passed, hopefully we get the cooking pot cleaned out and we can put it to use. And that is, I think, how it feels when a person has the Dharma on board, if you know what I mean. At first, Dharma is something that's strange and foreign, and we wonder, how could we ever really practice it? It seems attractive, and yet it's difficult. But as we practice it and as we get adjusted to it, our mind begins to calm down. As we meditate, our mind begins to calm. And as our mind begins to calm, we actually feel a little bit happier as it's calming down. And that little glimpse of relief and happiness makes us go on. It helps us to keep practicing. It helps us to keep meditating. And then after we keep meditating, then more benefit. And then eventually our ability to practice Dharma becomes second nature. At first, the idea of being patient and ethical and generating compassion and kindness, it seems like a foreign thing, something we're artificially putting on and might actually be a little bit dishonest or a little fake. But as we practice, eventually it becomes second nature. And we actually begin to genuinely feel compassion for people instead of just an intellectual kind of compassion that we have to work on to feel. And then eventually over time, this, they call it suppleness, like the suppleness of body that one gets from doing physical activities like yoga and tai chi. That physical suppleness, there's also a spiritual, mental, and emotional suppleness so that when things happen, we can deal with them. This is the benefit of doing meditation over a period of time. But we have to be motivated. We have to be motivated to meditate. And if we're not motivated to meditate, we'll never start. And so today's talk is about this, is about how to be motivated. The Gampopa, and I'm not going to be able to teach Jewel Ornament of Liberation in four talks because it's a little big. So what I'm going to teach instead is the four sayings of Gampopa called the four dharmas of Gampopa. I tried to have copies of the four dharmas available for today, but I don't think they're here. So we'll have to try to have them for our next talk on the 23rd. It goes like this. It's a short prayer. It goes like this. Grant your blessing that my mind follows the Dharma. Grant your blessing that my Dharma follows the path. Grant your blessing that the path be cleared of confusion. And grant your blessing that confusion may dawn as wisdom. I know, that last one sounds pretty interesting. But we have to get there. And we get there slowly. We start with, may my mind follow the Dharma. If we look at the story of Gampopa, he lived, he was born in the 1000s of the common era, of the current era, and he died in the middle of the 12th century in the 1100s. He was, I guess you could say he was very fortunate in that he became a monastic after a tragedy in his life. He could have been consumed by the tragedy that occurred in his life, but he was not. He was a physician before he became a monk. He was a physician who was extremely gifted and talented. But as his story is told, he was unable to save his wife. His wife died of an illness that he could not prescribe for. He couldn't give her a treatment that would work, and she died. On her deathbed, she extracted a promise from him. She said, "Promise me you will not marry another after I die." And he made the promise. After her death, he was somewhat, I guess you could say, uprooted. And he wandered a bit. But then he realized that if he kept his promise to his wife, that things might go well. And he realized the only way to keep his promise to her was to ordain as a monastic. Then he would never marry. And so he ordained as a monastic in the Kadampa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism and became a scholar. He learned all about the philosophy of Buddhism and all about the practices of Buddhism. He trained in a specific lineage of teachers that went all the way back to the first Buddhists to come to Tibet from India. And then practiced and became, I guess you could say, well known. However, his journey took a bit of a turn when he encountered, I guess you could call him a crazy wisdom yogi, a great meditator who lived in the mountains named Milarepa. Some of you may have heard of Milarepa. Milarepa, the notorious murderer who, through black magic, killed 35 people to settle a revenge that his mother wanted him to extract against her kinsman. Everybody who has heard the story of Milarepa knows it to be the ultimate redemption story. Because here's a person who was poisoned by his mother's wish for revenge, extracted that revenge, and then felt intense remorse. And following the advice to gain redemption for his crimes, he went in search of a spiritual teacher who could purify him of his wrongs and bring him to awakening. He met that person in the character of Marpa, the translator, who was a landowner, who then, meeting Milarepa, knew instantly of his promise, of his possibility as a Dharma practitioner. Marpa also knew of his crimes, and determined that he would purify Milarepa of his negativity by putting him to work. Milarepa was asked to build towers for Marpa and did so over a period of many months because Marpa would keep telling him, "No, you're not building it the way I want. Take it down and start again." Put all those rocks back, by the way. And so over and over again, Marpa slowly purified Milarepa of his arrogance, because as a black magician who could do just about anything, he felt very powerful. And so Marpa slowly broke that arrogance and turned Milarepa into a great practitioner. Milarepa became a great yogi, practicing alone in the mountains all of the great practices of the day, including the great six dharmas of Naropa. He learned inner heat practice. He learned dream yoga. He learned all kinds of amazing practices of the Vajrayana. And having learned these, he became enlightened. Then he began to wander and teach. And it was during this period of wandering and teaching that he encountered this physician who had become a monk named Gampopa. And when Milarepa encountered Gampopa, Milarepa was having a Vajrayana feast, and he had been served a bit of liquor. And he saw Gampopa coming, and he offered it to him and said, "Here, it's been blessed, and it is wisdom nectar. Drink it." And Gampopa said, "I'm sorry, sir. I'm a monk. I cannot touch alcohol." And Milarepa said, "If you want to become a yogi, you will do as I say." And Gampopa then took the vessel and drank it. And in that moment, he became a follower of Milarepa. And then he followed Milarepa for many years, learned all of the mystic practices of the Vajrayana, and became a great yogi himself. Afterward, he joined these two philosophies together. Gampopa is known as the one who united two streams into one. He united the ethical tenets and great bodhicitta practices of the Kadampa with the Vajrayana practices. And that gave birth to what we call the Kagyu tradition, K-A-G-Y-U, Kagyu. And so you could say that I've just given you a view into our personal family tree as practitioners. I've just talked to you about some of our distant relatives spiritually. Because what's interesting about the teachings of the Dharma that are presented in this place is that they actually come from a tradition that starts with the Buddha Shakyamuni, and then the teachings of the Buddha Shakyamuni went from India to Tibet, and were practiced by Tibetans who made them into, I guess you could say, they systematized them into groupings of practices. And then those groupings of practices came through lineages of enlightened masters to today. All of the people whose names I've given you are people who really genuinely lived. They lived, and they practiced, and they attained Buddhahood. And after they attained Buddhahood, they passed on their practices and their realization to the next generation. And that has gone on in an unbroken line since the time of the Buddha, and definitely since the time our lineage was given birth to in the 1100s. In the 1100s, late in the 1100s, Gampopa's main disciple, Dusam Chenpa, became known as the Karmapa. And after this, all of those who followed Dusam Chenpa became the followers of Karmapa. And then he was the first of the Tolkus, or reincarnate teachers of Tibet. And so the Karmapa's tradition is the tradition that we follow here. And so you could say that we have quite an interesting family tree and a very interesting family story, replete with unusual relatives who lived in caves and who practiced crazy wisdom and who brought others to fruition through the power of their inspiration. And so frequently when we talk about the Karmapas and the teachers of the past, some people will scratch their heads and say, "Well, who are all these people and what does it matter?" What does it matter? The reason it matters is because the teachings that we are teaching here, the quiet sitting meditation practice, the compassion meditation practice, the Chenrezig practice, Om Mani Padme Hung, the mantra Om Mani Padme Hung, the Tara practice, the mantra Om Tare, Tu Tare Turi Soha, the medicine Buddha practice, Te Ata Om Bekanze Bekanze Ma Bekanze Radha Samangate Soha. All of these practices, including the Mahamudra meditation practices and the preliminaries of Nundro that precede them, all of these practices have a heritage and come to us full of blessing. They come to us fully formed and full of blessing. They're actually being handed to us by the great masters of the past. And now we have both the joy and the difficulty of holding them. One Lama said to me, "Oh, the teacher's job is quite easy. It's the students who have the tough job. The teachers merely teach what was given to them. The students have to hold it. And not just hold it, they have to put it to use on themselves." Well, my goodness. More than once, during the time that I was learning Dharma, I felt this sort of momentary cold chill that you feel when you have a sudden realization about being responsible for something. This may have happened to you. For some people, it happens after you sign on the dotted line to buy a house, or sign on the dotted line to buy a car, or sign on the dotted line to marry someone. You know, there's this momentary cold chill of, am I equal to this? Can I do this? I remember it very vividly in all of those situations. So there's a time for every spiritual practitioner who is in a lineage when they think about all these great masters of the past, Milarepa and Gampopa, and they think, "Oh my goodness, they're giving it to me. What am I to do with it? Can I hold it? Could I just maybe give it to somebody else? Here, do you want this? Do I have to hold this lineage? Do I have to actually accomplish Buddhahood me? Seriously? Oh my goodness." There's that cold chill that you get. But after the cold chill passes, and it does, it can sometimes be replaced by a warmth. And the warmth is the warmth of the reassurances given to you by your teachers. Because we're handed this precious teaching, but then we're handed also, we're not handed it so and then sent off somewhere to try to figure it all out for ourselves. We're handed this teaching and this lineage, but then we are accompanied by someone who has already traveled that path, who can shed light when the path looks dark and shade when it gets too bright. We have someone who is willing and able to travel with us on the path. We are never alone. And that is the value of lineage. Studying the Dharma is not like taking a college course where sometimes the professor has office hours and sometimes not. And you have to try to figure it all out for yourself. You go to the lab and you can't figure out what's going on in the lab and you have no idea and you have to write a report and it's all insane. Instead, you have somebody who's going with you, who's going with you. And this is why we call it the teacher-student relationship. The teacher and student relationship is the relationship of someone who has already traveled that path and kind of knows where the potholes are and how to tell you where they are. And so the reason I gave this very long introduction to lineage is because I feel as though I would have liked to have heard this. Sometimes I feel like when I give a talk, I'm talking to my younger self. I'm talking to myself, the things I would have wanted to know when I started practicing. And the things that I kind of figured out but grew later as realizations from the teachings given by the Tibetans. So, you're in luck. Somebody was saying something to me about teaching last week. I was in Chicago last Sunday. By the way, your Dharma siblings in Chicago say hi. And somebody was saying, because I was teaching Chenrezig, they were saying, well, you know, how did you figure this out? And I said, I read a lot, and then my journalism degree does come in handy sometimes. If you have a four-year degree in how to explain things to people, it sometimes comes in handy. So the reason I wanted to teach about lineage was to give you an idea of how incredibly precious what we have here is. It's genuine. The teachings, it's not like a college course where you can take it and maybe get it and maybe not. You have someone who will walk with you. We have mentors and meditation instructors. We have people who have done these practices who can help you do them also. And that's what I think the value that we have is here, is that we can help you. So anyway, I had to say something about it because it was meaningful to me. And some people say to me, well, you know, when did you start getting serious about Dharma practice? And I said, probably not until I was in the middle of the three-year retreat. Until then, I was sort of better late than never, you know. Until then, I think I call myself a bit of a hobby Buddhist. Yeah, kind of. I'm a Buddhist because it sounds good. I'm a Buddhist because it kind of is attractive to me. But I haven't really taken it to heart yet. And then I just kind of kept doing whatever was next. You know, you finish doing some shamatha, and then they say, oh, now you can learn compassion meditation. So I started learning that. And then they say, oh, there's this Mahamudra meditation and Nundro. You can do all that. So I worked my way through that. And then they said, oh, there's this other practice, the Guru Yoga, Karmapaksha. You can do that. Okay, I did that. And then they said, well, you know, you could do three-year retreat. And I'm like, sure. So then I did that. And about in the middle, I said, hey, this stuff's for real. This lineage thing is like for real, and it's happening now. My goodness. And that was really when it sort of hit me that I could get serious about all this. And when I came out of retreat, they said, well, what did you learn? I said, I learned that the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma are real. We do have a precious human birth. We do have a precious human life. We have an opportunity that's unparalleled in the universe. We have Buddha nature and the situation for uncovering it. That's amazingly precious. Every person's life is value. Every person's life has meaning, and it's precious. Second, it's impermanent. It may not last forever, so we've got to work on it and work with our precious human life because it's impermanent. We have to get with it now. Karma is real. That means that everything we do, think, and say makes a difference. If we do a lot of what I did, which was goof off, if we did a lot of goofing off, you'll have to wait until you get halfway through three-year retreat before you get serious about Dharma. And then you'll go, what was I missing? Anyway, so karma is real. So everything we do, think, and say is moving us either toward awakening or away from it. We're either going toward awakening or we're going toward what the Buddha called this world of cyclic existence and suffering, or samsara. Samsara is cyclic existence of suffering. So we're either going toward it or away from it. The fourth of the thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma is that that samsara, as good as it looks some days, is ultimately disappointing. And I was talking to one of the Dharma students earlier today, and I said, you know, it's like you put your money in the candy machine, and the candy is hanging by that thread. You can't get it out of the machine, and you shake the machine, and you beat the machine, and then you get down on your knees and sneak your hand up inside the machine. You saw that TV show, too. Okay. It's just so you know, it's in one of the episodes of Monk. My husband and I did a binge watch a few years ago. Anyway, you can't get that, right? You just can't get it. That's us in samsara. We put our money in. We've invested so long in samsara. You know, this life that we think is somehow going to pay off. We're going to have like ultimate happiness from samsara. Ooh, ultimate happiness. And but it doesn't really happen like that. That it's ultimately, if it's as long as we're in samsara, sad to say, it's going to be ultimately disappointing because it's impermanent and it comes to an end. The only permanent happiness that can be found is through the practices of Dharma and being released from the clinging that has us on our knees trying to get that external happiness. And so that's the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma. And they are the essence of the first of these topics. May my mind, grant your blessing, that my mind follows the Dharma. In order to follow the teaching of the Buddha, we first have to have a little bit of a distance from samsara and its many traps and snares. And so in order to get that, what I call escape velocity from samsara, I remember learning about rockets in school, and they say that when a rocket is taking off, it has to get escape velocity from Earth's gravity or it'll never go into space. And so if we want to get escape velocity from samsara, we have to work at it by coming to an understanding of these four things, that our life is precious, that it's our life is precious because we have Buddha nature and we have this incredible potential, and that our life is short, so we have to work on our Dharma while we can, that everything we do, think, and say makes a difference. We're either going toward awakening or we're going away from it. And then finally, that samsaric happiness is because it's external and not anchored in our being, our Buddha nature, it's ultimately unsatisfying. And so these four things, these four thoughts that turn the mind toward the Dharma, are the way or the method. Reflecting upon these is the method for gaining this escape velocity from samsara. We won't be able to escape samsara until we realize that there is something holding us down. And so what I tell people is, if you want to practice this first of what are called the four teachings or the four dharmas of Gampopa, the way to practice the first of the four dharmas of Gampopa is to reflect, to actually contemplate the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma. Contemplate. You can do this either for about 5 minutes or 3 minutes every day while you're doing your meditation at home. It will help you get on your cushion, believe me. If you sit and reflect for like 3 to 5 minutes and think, I have a precious life. Wow, I have such a precious life. You know, even though I've been through terrible things, I'm still alive. Wow, even though I've been through trauma or difficulty, I am still here. I'm still here. And as they say, where there's life, there's hope. So, so if we reflect on that, there might be this moment where we think, wow, I really do have a precious life. Even if it's just for like a moment, this moment, momentary realization, like, wow, I'm lucky to be me right now. That is the culmination, or you could say the accomplishment of the first reflection, where you think, wow, I'm really lucky to be here. And when you do that, then you can say, may I use this. May I practice the Dharma now because it is the best use of my precious life. In fact, I tell people you could probably write the answer on your hand so you'd always have it handy. The resolution of each of these four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma is the phrase, I must practice Dharma. You can just write it on your hand so that you know the outcome of every contemplation. Precious human birth, I must practice Dharma. Impermanence, I must practice Dharma. Karma, I must practice Dharma. Defects of samsara, I must practice Dharma. It's the answer to all of them, because practicing Dharma is the only thing that makes sense. Yeah, coming to Buddhahood is the only thing that makes sense when you think about your precious human birth. Doing Dharma practice and becoming a Buddha is the only thing that makes sense when you think about impermanence. It's the only thing that makes sense when you think about karma. It's the only thing that makes sense when you think about the defects of samsara. So that's the answer. So now I've given you the answer so you can like write it down, put it on a piece of paper. It's your crib notes, you know, you could look it up when you need it. And this is how we make our mind follow the Dharma. I had a wonderful conversation this morning with a Dharma student. And we talked about how difficult it is when you're meditating to keep your mind on the technique. If you're doing sitting meditation and you're trying to follow the breath, comes and goes out, and then you get distracted, you want to go think about something that happened yesterday, or you're attracted that you want to think about something tomorrow. The person asked me, why does that happen exactly? Why does that happen? Why am I so easily taken off by these things? I said, well, Kempo Karthar Rinpoche, my teacher, once said, we are addicted to concepts. His wonderful translator Yeshe Jamso called it addictive conceptuality. Addictive conceptuality. We're addicted to the idea. He said we think that thinking is important. We think that thinking is important, and we become addicted to thinking. Like maybe I could just figure it all out. Maybe I could if I just think about it enough, I'll figure it all out. But it doesn't exactly work that way. But we become very convinced that our thoughts are somehow they're like tea leaves, and if we read them properly, we'll get it all figured out. Whereas from the Buddhist point of view, we just let go of the thoughts and return to the object of our meditation. We return to the breath over and over and over again and drop thinking. And then that's how we begin to break the addiction to conceptuality, to conceiving that there's some type of happiness and it's out there somewhere, away from us, external to us. And the only way to slowly dissolve that habit of looking outward for happiness is to begin to work with the generator of that idea. And as we work with the generator of that idea, the being, who we are, this mind, that is addicted to concepts and addicted to ideas and addicted to thoughts. If we start working with that, then we can begin to walk the process backwards and be enough. Be enough. I heard a lecture about meditation where the person was talking about their addiction to thinking while they're meditating. Yesterday's fantasy, tomorrow's fantasy, what's going on now? Anything just so I don't have to be here meditating because it's boring, you know. And I think what happens is that we get sort of, you know, addicted to these things because we want something to happen. We want something remarkable to occur rather than just being enough. The person who was writing the article said, isn't just resting your mind in itself enough? Isn't your mind It's not enough the way we see it right now because we're so busy, we're so used to filling our heads with ideas and things and entertainment and all of that. We have what are called the four obsessions, and I won't be able to remember them all. One of them is with entertainment and existence and happiness. And I forgot the other one. But we're obsessed with these things because we think that happiness is out there. We think that they bring happiness. So what we have to do is find a way for our mind to be enough. Enjoying being enough. And I think that's where I'll leave off today. I could start singing from the Hamilton soundtrack. That would be enough. Everybody knows I'm obsessed right now. It will get better because it's not enlightenment. Darn it, and I know that. Okay, so I think we'll stop here. The first of the four dharmas of Gampopa is, may my mind follow the Dharma, which means, may I see the teachings of the Buddha as a solution to the pain and suffering of samsara. May my mind follow the Dharma. may I wish for and aspire to practice meditation. May I wish for and aspire to practicing Buddhahood, and so forth. So that's the first of the four dharmas of Gampopa. May my mind follow the Dharma. And the way to turn our mind toward the Dharma is to recognize the defects of samsara, the truth of karma, the fact of impermanence, and the fact of our precious human life. So I got to stop here, because I would just keep going. That would probably not be good. I've only left us, as it is, about 7 minutes for questions, so I apologize. But I had to do two things. Actually three. I had to give you a bit of an update about the KTC and how things are going and ask you to sign that card. And I also wanted to give you a bit of a background into the importance of lineage and what lineage is and why Gampopa is so important, because his teachings on the four dharmas of Gampopa teach us how to be Dharma practitioners. And then, so I spent a little extra time on that. So anyway, but do you have like questions, curiosities, or do y'all want to sit and meditate now? Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
Yes.
Especially as far as the history of the lineage.
Sure.
And also the background of Milarepa.
Yes.
And I did not know that he had promised his mother as far as revenge.
Right.
Now, I have seen paintings as well as statues of Milarepa.
Yes.
Having his hand.
That's correct.
Up to his ear.
Correct.
And I have a book at home that says The Thousand Songs of Milarepa. And can you give me some information on about that aspect?
Milarepa is depicted in two attitudes. One attitude, his one leg is up, and his hand is like this. This pose is sometimes called the pose of, I'm trying to think of the right word. I'm going to call it despair, but that's not what it really means. I mean, the idea is that he has become weary of samsara. So the idea is like, it's a little bit like being depressed, but not the same. And so of this world weariness, that's this posture. But then the hand behind his ear refers to a couple of things. The main thing is that he sings. And his singing, and we see sometimes even today, we see people give themselves their own monitor of feedback to their own, they can hear their own voice and stay on key by listening, by cupping their hand, and then they can hear themselves more clearly as they sing to make sure they stay on key. And so he's this is a symbol of his singing. And he taught through song. Singing has always been a method for human beings to communicate with one another. Now I don't feel so bad about Broadway. So singing has always been a method for people to learn the truth. It's like the barb of truth will go through and you'll hear it and be touched by it through music. And so Milarepa, and by the cleverness of his words. And so that's the symbol. So he's world weary and is singing his realization. So that's the meaning of that pose. Yeah. Hi, Nina.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Yeah.
I have been anxious for about a month now. I'm having cataract surgery tomorrow. Everyone says it'll go really well, but it's like my eyes, right?
I understand.
So I haven't been sleeping all that well. My mind is just going for a minute.
So
what I've been doing recently is I'm lying in bed and I start doing a fresh start. So just going, don't think about your eye being blind.
Yeah.
Fresh start.
Sure.
And then just doing that.
Sure. You know, it's definitely a meditative exercise. I think for a lot of us, we practice meditation before we actually meditate. And so, yes, anytime you place your attention on something and return your attention again and again, it is a form of meditation. It's definitely a form of meditation. Will it have the same impact as doing meditation in different situations? I can't say because I don't know. But I definitely feel that if you bring your mind back again and again, it's definitely helpful. And what you can do tomorrow is that, do you know the medicine Buddha is like, it's like he looks like the Buddha Shakyamuni, but he's made of blue light. When you get there, see me after. I may have a blessing pill for you from here. And then you can take that before, because everybody's allowed to take a few medicines in the morning if you have morning medicines before your surgery, and I'll give you one. You can take it. And then you take off all of your protection cords and things like that. And then the pill is your protection. And then the other thing is you can dissolve. Imagine the medicine Buddha dissolves into the doctor, into the nurses, into the implements and everything. Just imagine, and into the medicines, the drops. You can actually visualize and imagine the medicine Buddha is, because you'll be given several bottles of eye drops when this is over, and then you can bless them each time. You keep the cap on because you have to keep the top clean, and then you can blow on the bottle, say mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, if that's the one you know. But if you know the Medicine Buddha mantra, you can say that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. This will be our last question. Good morning. Good morning. Yeah.
My question: in order to reach Buddha the way you yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you've really outlined it there, and that is that a person has to do some sort of meditation, because Kempo Karthar Rinpoche said, Buddhahood, or the experience of what's called the first level of bodhisattva awakening, they call it the first bhumi, or the first level of bodhisattva awakening, which is the start before Buddhahood. That first decisive breakthrough where you no longer are fooled by samsara. You know, you are now released from samsara. It's your get out of samsara free card. The when you experience that, he said, it happens in one moment. On your meditation seat. He says you sit down as an ordinary being and you get up as a first level bodhisattva. He says, however, it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen accidentally or incidentally. In other words, you have to learn how to practice. You have to learn how to meditate. You actually have to meditate. You don't just learn how, you actually do it. And you have the guidance of a teacher who can say, do this, oop, don't do that. Go here, oh, don't go there, you know, in terms of how do you do your meditation. Ooh, this is proper practice. Oop, you make a mistake here. The idea is that if you have that kind of guidance, then the first bhumi can happen for you. You can have that deep meditation. It will happen, but it won't happen by accident. You do not necessarily have to go on a 3-year retreat to do this type of practice. You have to be motivated. I think to me that's the main thing. You have to want to practice to that level. And you have to have deep caring for all sentient beings and develop what all of the texts call bodhicitta, this wish to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Without bodhicitta and without practicing compassion for yourself and compassion for others and completely and always refreshing this wish to become enlightened for their benefit, and then working on purifying your mind of all of its selfishness, slowly, gradually, over days, weeks, months, years, lifetimes. If you can do it, even if you can only get 1% closer to that goal, it's going to be to the good. Because it is better than going in the opposite direction or just sitting and being static. Well, if I can't become a Buddha, if I can't do 3-year retreat, then I should just give up meditating. It's not like that. Because every step, even as Siddhartha Rinpoche said, if I improve 1% each lifetime, 100 lifetimes, I'll be Buddha. And he says you get to keep everything you've done because of karma, because karma is real. You get to keep everything. And so what's really interesting is what you need to have is in the Great Path of Awakening, Jamgon Kontrol says, if you can practice the Bodhisattva motivation and have it with you from morning to night, this is excellent practice. And you don't even have to sit and meditate to do that. You just carry the wish to benefit beings in all activities, he says. Standing, sitting, sleeping, walking. Always hold this wish to be of benefit to others. And that's developing your Buddha nature just through the Bodhisattva attitude. So you don't even need to do formal practice. If you can hold that wish to be of benefit to others continuously, that purifies us of our selfishness and our clinging. So, I think that's the main thing. You don't have to be a recluse. You don't have to be a recluse. Milarepa, by the way, it's a funny story. Milarepa did have to be a recluse, actually. Because people said to him, hey, you know, your teacher, Marpa, he's got a wife. He's got sons. He's got a beautiful home. He's got animals. You know, he's a farmer. He's got a lot of stuff. Why can't you? You're sitting in a cave, Milarepa. Why can't you be like him? And he says, because I'm not him. He can have all of those things and not cling to a single one. If I had all those things, I'd be all over it. And he says, I have to go to the cave or I can't practice. So everybody has a different path. Everybody has a different path. Boy, I'm so glad you asked that question. See, so what this means is that whatever practice we can do, oh, this is really cute. Do you remember, Jim Dunn was a member of our center for many years. Jim Dunn was a member of our center for many years, and he used to quote his Theravadan teacher, who says, you know, we spend a lot of time judging our meditation, and it's really unnecessary. We shouldn't be sitting here and judging our meditation. He said, a good meditation is one you actually did. That's a good meditation. Even if you wandered around a lot, a good meditation is one you actually did. So, anyway, all I can say is, I'm having fun talking to you guys. I'm sorry, but we do have to stop here. We got to deal with the synagogue. We have to leave by, you know, a certain time. So it is always a joy and a pleasure to be here and to see all of you. And I want to thank all of you again for bringing your sincerity to this place, because you invest this place with goodness when you bring your sincerity here. It may be that we are in God's basement. Think about it. It's like being in mom's basement, you know, only, you know, we don't quite have a job yet, you know, and we don't have a place of our own yet, but so we're kind of in God's basement right now, but we're working our way out. But you have invested this place with so much goodness, and you will continue to do so, because as my friends in 12-step like to say, you keep coming back. Just keep coming back and bringing your goodness here. And we appreciate it. Okay, so let's sit quietly for just a moment and mentally dedicate the goodness of our session. We mentally dedicate the goodness of our session to all suffering beings. May all beings be free from their suffering. May they be free from suffering and its causes. May they have goodness and its causes. May they become Buddhas, and may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.